in my personality psychology class at SDSU. She says her parents didn't want her to work in high school, so looking for a job when she entered college was a rude shock. No one would hire me due to my lack of experience, and even when I finally did get a job, I wasn't acting in a professional manner on the job, and I ended up getting fired a few months later, she wrote. If I had worked in high school, regardless of where, I would have known how to behave on the job. In fact, if I had had a job, I probably would have learned a discipline and work ethic that would have helped me in many areas of my life. I would have learned the importance of attendance, which is something I have a huge struggle with when it comes to school and appointments. I never learned what it was like to earn something. Jobs can also confer benefits on specific populations. One study found that disadvantaged teens randomly assigned to a summer jobs program were 43% less likely to be involved in violence. Most of the effect occurred after the 8-week job period was over, suggesting that employment had a longer-term beneficial effect than simply filling time. For teens bound for college, a part-time job can provide badly needed funds, especially in the current era of rising tuition costs and the large debt burden many students find themselves with after college graduation. Whether it's good or bad, working is yet another adult activity teens are putting off until later. Taking out loans from the bank of mom and dad. I meet Ellie, 16, at her high school. We sit outside her classroom and talk on a sunny fall day just before lunch. She's a pretty junior with long, light brown hair who tells me all about using geotagging to post to Instagram. She has put off getting her driver's license, but hopes to take care of that soon, since her parents still have to drop her off at the mall when she wants to hang out with her friends. I ask her if she has a job, and she says no, she also doesn't get an allowance. So do your parents buy you the things that you want? Is that how it works? I ask. Yeah, she says. Like usually if I need money, they will, like, give it to me or something. Usually I just ask them. They don't always, but sometimes. With fewer teens working, you might think that more would get an allowance to buy the things they want. However, fewer iGeners get an allowance. When teen employment began to drop in the 1980s, parents at first responded by giving more teens an allowance. But after 2000, fewer teens got an allowance and many fewer had money from a job, leaving 20% of these 17 and 18-year-olds without any money of their own to manage. When they need money, they must, like Ellie, ask for it from their parents. It's yet another example of 18-year-olds now being like 15-year-olds, just like children and young adolescents. One out of 5 iGen high school seniors asks their parents for what they want, instead of managing their own cash flow. It's hard to say whether this parental control of funds is the parents' or the teens' idea. If it's the parents', it suggests that parents think high school seniors aren't ready to manage their own money. Or maybe teens have realized they'll get more money out of their parents by asking, rather than having a set allowance. Either way, the result is more young people graduating from high school without even the introductory money-managing experience of figuring out how to spend on movies, gas, and meals out, a kind of training ground for the larger adult job of paying for rent, utilities, and food. You booze, you lose. I reach Chloe, 18, on her cell phone just as school lets out on a mild spring Wednesday. She's a senior at a high school in a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio, and has just decided that she'll go to college at Ohio State. I'm so excited, she says. When she was younger, she thought she might pursue a career in fashion, but she now thinks she'll major in psychology. When I ask her about her favorite TV shows, she admits with a tinge of embarrassment that she likes Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Not for the drama, she clarifies, but because of the glimpse it provides into a posh California lifestyle. She also loves watching funny animal videos online. Most of the time, she and her friends hang out at the mall or go for frozen yogurt. She has a boyfriend, a part-time job, and a driver's license, but other adult activities hold little appeal for her. When I ask about going to parties and drinking, for example, she's skeptical of the whole scene. People I work with will say, I went down to the university this weekend and I got messed up or whatever, and I hooked up with some guy. It's just like drunken mistake stuff, she says. "And that doesn't sound appealing to you?" I ask, somewhat teasingly. "No, I don't understand why people would not want to be in control of themselves or their actions," she says. Chloe is more typical of her iGen peers than you might realize. Fewer and fewer drink alcohol. Nearly 40% of iGen high school seniors in 2016 had never tried alcohol at all, and the number of eighth graders who have tried alcohol has been cut nearly in half. The decline in trying alcohol is the largest in the youngest groups and by far the smallest among young adults. The decline is a steep black diamond mountain for eighth graders, a bunny hill for 12th graders, and a gently sloping cross-country ski course for young adults. Nearly all young adults have tried alcohol, and that has declined only slightly over the decades. What's changed is the age when they first start drinking. In the early 1990s, the average eighth grader had already tried alcohol, but by 2014, the average 10th grader had not. That means most iGen teens are putting off trying alcohol until the spring of 10th grade or later. They are growing more slowly into the adult activity of drinking alcohol. Similar trends show up for alcohol use in the last month, and in other surveys such as the CDC's Youth Risk Behavior Surveillance Survey of Teens. The steep decline in alcohol use for the youngest teens is especially encouraging. Most people would agree that 13- and 14-year-olds drinking is not a good idea. When they get to 10th and 12th grade, and drinking can be combined with driving, it's also a big public health benefit that fewer young people are imbibing. These are huge and encouraging changes. There is one downside to these trends. More young people arrive on college campuses or enter adult life without much experience drinking. Since drinking among college students and young adults hasn't changed much, iGen is ramping up their drinking over a much shorter period of time than did previous generations. Many are going from 0 to 60 in their alcohol experience in a short time. That's especially true for binge drinking, usually defined as having 5 or more drinks in a row. Binge drinking is the most dangerous kind of alcohol use, as it is the most likely to lead to alcohol poisoning, poor judgment, and drunk driving. The number of 18-year-olds who binge drink has been cut in half since the early 1980s, but binge drinking among 21 to 22-year-olds has stayed about the same. The rapid increase in binge drinking from age 18 to age 21 can be risky. A study of this trend by the National Institutes of Health concluded, any increase in heavy drinking from age 18 to 21-22 increases the risk of negative consequences. It is likely that the faster the increase, the less experience one has with heavy drinking situations, and the more risk is involved. This phenomenon is especially acute for those who attend college. High school students bound for college are less likely to drink alcohol than those who don't plan on attending college, but once they get there, they are more likely to binge drink than those who are not in college. For college students, the experience curve is very steep. As one college student put it, "I'm 21 and in my prime drinking years, and I intend to take full advantage of it." This can be a challenge for student affairs professionals and others helping young people navigate their college years, as students are arriving on campus fairly naive about drinking, but are quickly immersed in a culture of heavy alcohol consumption. What about drug use? The heyday of illicit drug use among teens, the vast majority of which is marijuana, was in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Use then plummeted in the early 1990s before going back up again through the 2000s and 2010s. With drug use, there's very little difference between 18-year-olds and 21- to 22-year-olds, and drug use ticks up a little in the transition to iGen in the early 2010s. Why the different patterns for alcohol and drug use? Drug use, at least in most states, is illegal at any age. Any rule-breaking is roughly equal for drug use whether you are over or under 21. Buying alcohol, however, becomes legal at 21. Perhaps why this cautious generation is more likely to avoid it as teens, yet still indulges after they turn 21. As more states legalize recreational marijuana for adults, this pattern may change. We'll explore more about these trends in Chapter 6 on safety. For now, iGen drinks less but smokes pot more than the millennials who preceded them. Growing up slowly. So, compared to their predecessors, iGen teens are less likely to go out without their parents, date, have sex, drive, work, or drink alcohol. These are all things adults do that children do not. Most people try them for the first time as teens, the transitional time between childhood and adulthood. As high school students, iGeners are strikingly less likely to experience these once nearly universal adolescent milestones, those breathtaking first experiences of independence from your parents that leave you feeling, for the first time, that you're an adult. Even iGeners who do reach these milestones during high school are doing so at older ages than in previous generations. That includes both the pleasures of adulthood, such as sex and alcohol, and the responsibilities of adulthood, such as working and driving. For good or for ill, iGen teens are not in a hurry to grow up. 18-year-olds now look like 14-year-olds once did, and 14-year-olds like 10 or 12-year-olds. The full story of growing up slowly began long before iGen. The first changes in developmental speed appeared not among teens, but among young adult Gen Xers in the 1990s, who began to postpone the traditional milestones of adulthood such as settling into a career, getting married, and having children. The average boomer woman in 1975 married at 21. The average Gen Xer in 1995 married at 25. Working at a full-time career was also postponed until later, as more young people went to college. Yet, Gen Xer teens didn't slow down. They were just as likely to drive, drink alcohol, and date as their boomer peers, and more likely to have sex and get pregnant as teens. But then they waited longer to reach full adulthood with careers and children. So, Gen Xers managed to lengthen adolescence beyond all previous limits. They started becoming adults earlier and finished becoming adults later. Beginning with millennials, and then going full speed with iGen, adolescence is becoming shortened again, at the lower end. Childhood has lengthened, with teens treated more like children, less independent and more protected by parents than they once were. The entire developmental trajectory, from childhood to adolescence to adulthood, has slowed. Adolescence, the time when teens begin to do things adults do, now happens later. 13-year-olds and even 18-year-olds are less likely to act like adults and spend their time like adults. They are more likely, instead, to act like children, not by being immature necessarily, but by postponing the usual activities of adults. Adolescence is now an extension of childhood rather than the beginning of adulthood. Is this because teens are more responsible? In a 2014 op-ed for The Washington Post, the sociologist David Finkelhor argued that iGen teens, with their lowered alcohol use, reduced crime rates, and more limited sexuality, are showing virtues their elders lacked. He concluded, "We may look back on today's youth as relatively virtuous, as the ones who turned the tide on impulsivity and indulgence. Today's teens, he believes, should be praised for being so responsible." A 2016 Post article continued with this theme, trumpeting, "Today's teens are way better behaved than you were." Other observers, such as the 20-year-old writer Jess Williams, have spun the same trends more negatively. Williams describes iGen as boring. "Teens just aren't any fun anymore," she says. One magazine agreed, headlining a recent article, "Charting the Rise of Generation Yawn. 20 is the New 40. In my view, these characterizations miss the point. Terms such as virtue, indulgence, better behaved, and boring focus solely on whether the trends are good or bad. This approach is incomplete, including only some of the generational differences while leaving others out entirely. For example, none of these articles mentions that iGen teens are also less likely to work at a job, have a driver's license, stay at home alone, or manage their own money, activities not necessarily associated with being more or less virtuous, responsible, better behaved, or boring. As a whole, the trends do not unequivocally support the idea that adolescents have become more responsible, virtuous, or boring, and thus perhaps are more like adults. But the trends do nearly unequivocally support the idea that teens are growing up more slowly and are thus less like adults. Only growing up more slowly explains why working, driving, staying alone, and managing one's own money would also decline among teens. Neither better behaved nor boring captures what's really going on with iGen. they are simply taking longer to grow up. Instead, it's more informative to employ the terms of life history theory discussed earlier. Teens have adopted a slow life strategy, perhaps due to smaller families and the demands wrought by increasing income inequality. Parents have the time to cultivate each child to succeed in the newly competitive economic environment, which might take 21 years when it once took 16. The cultural shift toward individualism may also play a role. Childhood and adolescence are uniquely self-focused stages, so staying in them longer allows more cultivation of the individual self. With fewer children and more time spent with each child is noticed and celebrated. Sure enough, cultural individualism is connected to slower developmental speeds across both countries and time. Around the world, young adults grow up more slowly in individualistic countries than collectivistic ones. And as American culture has grown more individualistic from 1965 to the present, young adults have taken longer and longer to enter adult work and family roles. There's another factor, too. Several well-publicized studies of brain development have shown that the frontal cortex, the brain area responsible for judgment and decision-making, does not complete its development until age 25. This has spawned the idea that teens are not quite ready to grow up, and thus need more protection for a longer time. These findings about underdeveloped teen brains have generated numerous books, articles, and online parenting advice. Interestingly, the interpretation of these studies seems to ignore a fundamental truth of brain research, that the brain changes based on experience. Maybe today's teens and young adults have an underdeveloped frontal cortex because they have not been given adult responsibilities. If brain scanners existed in 1950, I wonder what they would have shown of a generation that usually started work at 18, married at 21, and had children soon after. That interpretation of such studies is never offered, however, leaving parents believing that their teen and young adult children are biologically programmed to make poor choices. So they think it's better to protect them as long as possible. Partners, not prisoners. Here's another key question. Are teens willing participants in growing up more slowly, or are parents strong-arming them into it? It would be easy to imagine teens chafing against being treated like children. But if growing up slowly is a natural adaptation to the culture, they might be more willing to go along with it. Parents do keep a closer watch over teens these days. More teens say that their parents always know where they are and who they are with when they go out at night. This surveillance is probably facilitated by phone tracking apps that allow parents to see where their teens are. Yet, the apps can't tell parents whom their kids are with, and teens say their parents know that too. It's another sign of growing up slowly, like the mother at the playground who knows whether her 5-year-old is about to run in front of the swings. The parents of teens are more likely to know where their kids are and whom they're with. Most adults can remember being a teen and chafing against this kind of parental meddling. Who's going to be at the party? I don't know, people. Or upon your return from downtown, possibly but not definitely, maybe having had a drink or two, we went bowling. Yeah, bowling. Given the teen tendency to resist restrictions, you'd think teens and their parents would get into more fights. The easiest way to get into a fight with a teen is to take her car keys away, right? And that's effectively what's happened to iGen en masse. If iGen teens don't like the restrictions, they should fight with their parents more than previous generations did. However, iGen teens fight less with their parents. The number who had a serious fight with their parents more than 3 times a year fell from 66% in 2005 to 56% in 2015. So, iGen is not only kept on a tighter leash by their parents, but also fight with them less, bucking the Boomer and Gen X assumption that teens will automatically battle parental restrictions. iGen teens and parents are on the same page, the page of growing up more slowly. In the most extreme cases of resistance to parents, teens might consider running away. Since running away is virtually never a parent's idea, it gives a view into what teens are thinking on their own, their deepest feelings unfettered by parental guidance. As it turns out, running away is less common among iGen. The number of teens who say they've tried to leave home plummeted in just the 5 years from 2010 to 2015. Thankfully, teens are less likely to consider making a break for independence. So apparently, teens are along for the ride of growing up more slowly. They are willingly staying children for longer. A recent study found that iGen college students, versus students in the 1980s and 1990s, scored markedly higher on a measure of maturity fears. iGeners were more likely to agree, "I wish that I could return to the security of childhood," and "the happiest time in life is when you are a child." They were less likely to agree, "I would rather be an adult than a child," and "I feel happy that I am not a child anymore." Instead of resenting being treated like children, iGeners wish they could stay children for longer. Many people now seem to associate being a child, as opposed to being an adult, with less stress and more fun. Witness the 2014 emergence of the neologism adulting, which means taking care of one's responsibilities. The Adulting School in Maine now offers classes for young adults teaching them how to perform tasks such as managing finances and folding laundry. The Twitter hashtag adulting features posts such as, "One thing I hate about adulting? Paying bills. I'm just gonna lay in bed. I don't feel like adulting today." And, "Remember when you were a kid and counted the number of days until school was out? Hashtag adulting needs something like that." The word adult is now used as a verb, and it seems to mean the end of all fun. When you're drunk at 4 a.m. and realize you have to get up and hashtag adult in 5 hours. Or, when everyone's all snuggled in bed and I'm walking out the door to go to work. I'm done adulting. Many echo the idea that growing up is no fun. Wrote one Twitter user, "How are people excited to turn 18? I'm very scared of adulting." Another posted, "I miss the trivial and juvenile concerns I had as a child, things like crayon sets and cute playdates. Adulting sucks. I want to quit." How exactly can you quit being an adult? That's not explained. Recent years have seen a boom in products such as adult coloring books that invite full-grown humans to color with crayons like elementary schoolers, touting the activity as relaxing. A 2016 article in Adweek noted that brands are tapping into millennials' anxiety about growing up. When I interviewed Josie, a 17-year-old high school senior in the midst of applying to college, I asked her what her favorite movies were. Her answer? Tangled and Frozen, both children's movies by Disney. Instead of longing to be older as many previous generations did, remember Tom Hanks in the movie Big in the 1980s? Kids like being kids. In a 2013 poll, 85% of 8 to 14-year-olds agreed, "I like being my age," up from 75% in 2003. When 7-year-old Hannah was asked, "Do you want to be older?" she replied, "No, I like being a kid. You get to do more things." When I asked 20 iGeners why being a child was better than being an adult, almost all said that being an adult involved too much responsibility. When they were children, they said, their parents had taken care of everything, and they'd just gotten to have fun. I could take care of my own desires, more or less, without ever having to worry about the logistics or practicality of making them real, wrote Elizabeth, 22. Nor was I ever really forced to encounter the consequences of having fun or taking a day off. It was just something I would do. In other words, as children, they could live in a cocoon with all of the fun but little of the work. Their parents made childhood a wonderful place with lots of praise, an emphasis on fun, and few responsibilities. No wonder they don't want to grow up. Even once they get to college, students' parents continue to treat them like children. Parents register their adult children for classes, remind them of deadlines, and wake them up in time for class, observed Julie Lithcott-Hames, the former freshman dean at Stanford. Cell phones made that easy. These students weren't mortified when their parents did all of this, as my generation and the ones before it would have been. They were grateful, she notes. Grateful to be able to communicate with a parent multiple times a day, in the dorm, in the dining halls, in the student union, going to class, going to another class, going somewhere after class, in the lobby of the advising office, even in my office. Or they tried to. "It's my mom," they'd say sheepishly with a small shrug. "Do you mind if I just get this? I'll just..." "Mom?" Over her decade in the job, Lithcott-Haim says students began referring to themselves as kids. Thus, the generational sweep is complete. Never having known another parenting style, iGen doesn't rebel against their parents' overprotection. Instead, they embrace it. "We want you to treat us like children, not adults," one college student told a startled faculty member. Some suggest that this cocoon mentality is behind recent campus trends such as trigger warnings, to alert students that a reading or lecture material might be disturbing, and safe spaces, where students can go if they are upset by a campus speaker's message. One safe space, for example, featured coloring books and videos of frolicking puppies, neatly connecting the idea of safe spaces with that of childhood. No matter what the reason, teens are growing up more slowly, eschewing adult activities until they are older. This creates a logical question. If teens are working less, spending less time on homework, going out less, and drinking less, what are they doing? For a generation called iGen, the answer is obvious. Look no further than the smartphones in their hands. Chapter 2. Internet. Online time. Oh, and other media too. The New York Police Department's 33rd Precinct recently warned residents about a danger lurking in their beds: their phones. Several had caught fire when people kept them under their pillows while they slept, creating clickbait pictures of scorched phones and beds with large brown burn marks. A similar incident happened in Texas, where a 13-year-old girl woke to the smell of something burning. Her charging phone, tucked under her pillow, had overheated and melted into the sheets. It turned out that some Samsung phones had a spectacular issue with spontaneously combusting batteries. But to me, the flaming cell phone wasn't the only surprising thing in these stories. Why would anyone have her phone under her pillow, my Gen X self wondered. It's not as though you can surf the web while you're sleeping. And who could slumber deeply inches from a buzzing phone? Curious, I asked my undergraduate students what I thought was a very simple question. What do you do with your phone while you sleep? Why? Their answers were a profile in obsession. Nearly all slept with their phones, putting them under their pillows, on the mattress, or at the very least within arm's reach of the bed. They checked social media websites and watched videos right before they went to bed, and reached for their phones again as soon as they woke up in the morning. They had to. All of them used it as their alarm. Their phone was the last thing they saw before they went to sleep, and the first thing they saw when they woke up. If they woke up in the middle of the night, they often ended up looking at their phones. They talked about their phones the way an addict would talk about crack. "I know I shouldn't, but I just can't help it," one said about looking at her phone while in bed. Some saw their phones as a lifeline, or as an extension of their bodies, or like a lover. "Having my phone closer to me while I'm sleeping is a comfort," wrote Molly, 20. Smartphones are unlike any other previous form of media, infiltrating nearly every minute of our lives, even when we are unconscious with sleep. While we are awake, the phone entertains, communicates, glamorizes. Asar, the high school senior we met in Chapter 1, is a good example. When I ask to take her picture, she sweeps her long dark hair to the front and chirps, "Have to look pretty." I ask what her favorite apps are. She names Instagram, Snapchat, and one I hadn't heard of called iFunny. When I ask if she can show me how iFunny works, she gets visibly excited and says, "Really? I can take out my phone?" And proceeds to show me all of the areas of the site, keeping up a constant patter about all of the funny memes and videos. When the wireless signal starts to waver, she sighs in frustration. "Where is it? My internet, no!" Her phone plan, she tells me, has unlimited data and texting, but only 100 minutes of talk time a month, because I never call people. She keeps her phone out for the rest of the interview, showing me pictures and apps. It seems obvious that teens, and the rest of us, spend a lot of time on phones, not talking but texting, on social media, online, and gaming. Together, these are sometimes labeled new media. Sometime around 2011, we arrived at the day when we looked up, maybe from our own phones, and realized that everyone around us had a phone in his or her hands. But maybe what we see in the coffee line or at the dinner table isn't representative, and the endless parental and media hand-wringing over screen time isn't necessary. Maybe the smartphone obsession is pronounced only in middle-class and affluent communities, or maybe we just don't notice the teens who aren't always on their phones. Fortunately, we can turn to the large, nationally representative overtime surveys, since they ask teens how much time they spend online, gaming, and texting. So how much time is it? The short answer is a lot. iGen High School seniors spent an average of 2.25 hours a day texting on their cell phones, about 2 hours a day on the internet, 1.5 hours a day on electronic gaming, and about a half hour on video chat in the most recent survey. That totals to 6 hours a day with new media, and that's just during their leisure time. Eighth graders, still in middle school, were not far behind, spending 1.5 hours a day texting, 1.5 hours a day online, 1.5 hours a day gaming, and about half an hour on video chat, a total of 5 hours a day with new media. This varies little based on family background. Disadvantaged teens spent just as much or more time online as those with more resources. The smartphone era has meant the effective end of the internet access gap by social class. Considering that teens spend about 17 hours a day in school, sleeping, and on homework and school activities, nearly all of their leisure hours are now spent with new media. The hour and a half that's left is used up by TV, which teens watch about 2 hours a day. Of course, this makes it look as if they have more than 24 hours in their days, but more than likely, they are multitasking, texting while web surfing, watching TV while posting to Instagram. They might also be sleeping less, a possibility we'll return to in Chapter 4. Overall, teens spend much more time online now than they did just a few years ago. 12th graders in 2015 spent twice as much time online as 12th graders in 2006. Even with multitasking included, 6 hours a day is a staggering amount of time. What are teens doing with that time? Lots of texting. The teens I talked to all said it's the primary way they communicate with their friends. About what? Many of the same things adults text about, but more often. I am usually texting my girlfriend over random things, school items and relationship issues. I also text my friends and just send jokes throughout the day, wrote Victor, 18. I text my best friend or my boyfriend, said Eva, 19. We are generally talking about something funny that happened during the day, or just checking in to see how their day is going, anything new that's happened since we last talked. Texting has mostly replaced talking on the phone. In 2015, teens talked on the phone about 45 minutes a day, about a third of the time they spent texting. The surveys did not start asking about texting until 2010, when the practice was already well established, so we can't really see its popularity take off from non-existent in the 1990s to a two-hour-a-day activity by 2010. From 2010 to 2015, the time teens spent texting actually declined slightly, by about 13 minutes a day. Why? Probably because they were spending more time on social media. Everybody's doing it. Social media. As my rental car rumbles up the dirt road, I can see the barn in the distance against the green cornfields and blue sky of a summer day in rural Minnesota. Emily and her family are there when I pull up at the lake cabin where Emily's extended family has gathered for the July 4th weekend. Emily is 14 and has just finished her freshman year in high school. A member of the track team, she's runner lean, with wavy blonde hair in loose braids and a wide, happy smile that shows off her braces. She ends most sentences with a happy, "So, yeah." Emily lives in the Twin Cities, 2 hours away, but her best friend lives at the farm next door to the lake cabin, and the two shuttle back and forth frequently. So the first order of the day is for me to meet Emily's cow, Liberty, born 2 years ago on the 4th of July. Barefoot, Emily hops the fence at the barn door and brings Liberty over, smiling as we take her picture next to the huge black-and-white animal, looking at us warily with dark brown eyes. A girl on a farm, braids swinging, showing off her cow, It's a timeless scene, at home at any time in the last 200 years. But it's not just any time, and Emily is like most iGen teens in the 2010s. She connects with her friends through social media, partially because it's virtually mandatory. Everyone uses it, she says. It's a good way to, like, make plans with people. If you don't, you might miss out on plans that you could have gone to. Emily got her first smartphone fairly late for an iGener at the beginning of ninth grade, but already finds it indispensable. When I ask her what apps she uses, she says, the main ones are Snapchat, Instagram, and Twitter. I'll get updates from the track team and watch funny videos. I post pictures from my track meets, and just if I'm doing a fun activity with my family or my friends. A lot of other people post a ton of selfies, like every other post will be a selfie. She tells me how tagging photos on Instagram works. If someone doesn't tag you, that means you're not really friends anymore, or they're mad at you. This is the new reality of teen social life. It's conducted online for all to see, with clear messages about who's in and who's out. How much time are teens spending on social media, and is it really any different from 10 years ago? Social media sites are not new. The first social media sites appeared as early as 1997. MySpace debuted in 2003, and Facebook opened up to everyone over age 13 in 2006. I'll use the terms social networking sites and social media interchangeably. The Monitoring the Future survey first asked about social networking sites in 2008, so sadly late that the otherwise diligent survey administrators must have been asleep at the wheel. The question about social media use is very general, asking whether teens use social networking sites almost every day, at least once a week, once or twice a month, a few times a year, or never. Even with the survey late to the party and asking such a broad question, the growth in these sites' popularity is still very evident. In 7 years, social media sites went from being a daily activity for half of teens to almost all of them. That's especially true for girls. 87% of 12th grade girls used social media sites almost every day in 2015, compared to 77% of boys. The increases in use have been even larger for minority and lower-income teens. In 2008, white and higher SES, social scientists call this socioeconomic status, or SES, teens, were more likely to use social media sites every day. But by 2015, the race and class differences had disappeared. The daily use of social media sites is now an equal opportunity experience among teens. They have become almost required. In 2008, 14% of 12th graders said they never used the sites, enough to perhaps form a group. By 2015, those who never used them had dwindled to 3%. Only 2% of 12th grade girls said they never use social media sites. So 97% of 12th graders and 98% of 12th grade girls use social media sites at least sometimes, about as universal an experience as you can get. Social media also requires a specific strategy of self-presentation. Harper, 12, was the youngest iGener I interviewed. She and her aunt arrived at our house on a sunny spring afternoon, and we chatted as her aunt played with my kids. Harper still looks more like a kid than a teen, although she's used to wearing lots of makeup for the cheerleading competitions she participates in nearly every weekend. She lives in a small town in the California mountains, sometimes staying with her grandparents due to her parents' divorce. She already has an iPhone and uses it frequently. Like many teens I talked with, she agreed that social media was mostly for posting positive things, requiring a certain cultivation of one's image. Normally, you don't want to look sad on there, she said. She uses social media mostly to follow her friends on Instagram. If your friend is, like, out doing something, you can see all the cool things that they're doing, she says. No one does anything bad on it. We just see what each other is doing. The Washington Post recently profiled Catherine, a 13-year-old living in McLean, Virginia. The story described what she did on her iPhone during the 12-minute drive home from school. Her thumb is on Instagram. A Barbara Walters meme is on the screen. She scrolls and another meme appears, then another meme, and she closes the app. She opens BuzzFeed. There's a story about Florida Governor Rick Scott, which she scrolls past to get to a story about Janet Jackson. Then 28 things you'll understand if you're both British and American. She closes it. She opens Instagram. She opens the NBA app. She shuts the screen off. She turns it back on. She opens Spotify. Opens Fitbit. She has 7,427 steps. Opens Instagram again. Opens Snapchat. She watches a sparkly rainbow flow from her friend's mouth. She watches a YouTube star make pouty faces at the camera. She watches a tutorial on nail art. She feels the bump of the driveway and looks up. They're home. Catherine has 604 followers on Instagram and keeps only the photos that get enough likes. Over 100 likes is good for me, she says. When she changed her Snapchat username, her Snapchat score went to 0. Snapchat users get a point for every snap they send or receive. So, she sent 1,000 snaps in one day to up her score. She uses her phone so much that her father has had trouble finding a data plan to cover all of it. For her book, American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers, reporter Nancy Jo Sales interviewed hundreds of teen girls across the country about what they do on their phones and how it affects them. She described girls constantly in search of likes and positive comments on their pages, with persistent pressure to post sexy and revealing photos. Those, after all, get the most likes. One spring day, she interviewed a group of 13-year-olds in Montclair, New Jersey. The girls, just like the teens I interviewed, had a love-hate relationship with their phones and social media. I spend so much time on Instagram looking at people's pictures, and sometimes I'll be like, why am I spending my time on this? And yet, I keep doing it, said Melinda. If I go on my phone to look at Snapchat, I go on it like an hour. I lose track, noted Riley. The minute I start my homework, I have to have my phone by me to see what my friends are texting. It's like someone is constantly tapping you on the shoulder and you have to look, said Sophia. They'd like to stop, but feel they can't. When Melinda's parents deleted her Instagram app for a week as a punishment, by the end of the week I was stressing, like, what if I'm losing followers? I've always wanted to delete my Instagram, said Sophia, but then I think, I look so good in all my photos. Eventually, many iGenners see through the veneer of chasing likes, but usually only once they are past their teen years. James, 20, is a college student in Georgia. When you go on social media, you post a status or you post a picture, and all of a sudden you get all those likes. You get all those affirmations from people, and it can be addictive because you have the constant pats on the back that, like, you're smart, you're funny, you're attractive, he says. But, he acknowledges, I feel like it's also kind of hollow. This is, of course, a different world from the one Gen Xers and even millennials grew up in. You realize how insane things are today when you think about the relative rate of change, says Paul Roberts, the author of The Impulse Society, America in the Age of Instant Gratification. When I was in high school, if I had gone around saying, here's a picture of me, like me, I would have gotten punched. If a girl went around passing out naked pictures of herself, people would have thought she needed therapy. Now, that's just Selfie Sunday. So which sites are teens using? Social media sites go into and out of fashion, and by the time you read this book, several new ones will probably be on the scene. In fall 2016, the management firm Piper Jaffray found that only 30% of 14-year-olds used Facebook at least once a month, compared to 80% using Instagram and 79% using Snapchat. Those platforms were also growing among young adults. By spring 2016, Pew Research Center found that 59% of 18 to 29-year-olds used Instagram and 56% used Snapchat, a big increase since 2015. The teens I talked to in late 2015 and 2016 mentioned Instagram and Snapchat the most often. Most recently, group video chat apps such as House Party were catching on with iGen, allowing them to do what they call live chilling. Matthew, the 19-year-old Pennsylvania college student we met in Chapter 1, uses a Snapchat feature called Snap Story. If I'm at a tennis practice or at one of the dining halls with some friends, I'll take a video or a picture and add it to my Snap Story and share it with friends. I'll also see other friends' Snap Stories and see what they're doing, he says, On Snap Story, photos stay for 24 hours and then disappear, forming a continuous updated stream of photos that are sent to everyone you've tagged as a friend. It's easy, he says, because the app is basically just a camera, and the pictures upload much faster than they do to Facebook. It helps me stay in the loop and just know what's going on with everybody. Many teens use the regular version of Snapchat, in which pictures and messages automatically disappear. According to the company, Snapchat servers automatically delete snaps after they have been viewed. Teens see Snapchat as a safe way to talk to their friends because there is no embarrassing permanent record that can be shared around. A relatively new feature alerts users when someone has tried to keep their message by using a screenshot, and then they get mad at you, one teen told me. As we saw earlier, girls usually spend more time on social media sites than boys do. So what are boys doing instead? Often, they're playing video games, and so are many of the girls. Teens spend more time playing games on their computers than they did just a few years ago. 12th graders spend about 1.5 hours a day, compared to less than an hour a day in 2008. Girls have caught up quickly in video game time, perhaps due to less violent, more girl-friendly games on phones, such as Candy Crush. Gaming has what statisticians call a bimodal distribution. Some teens don't do it at all, and others do it a lot. In 2015, 27% of teens said they played video games less than an hour a week, and 9% said they played more than 40 hours a week, the time commitment of a full-time job. When I interview Max, 16, at his San Diego high school, and ask him about what he likes to do for fun, he says, play video games. He usually plays multiplayer games online, in which he can talk to other players through his headset, he tells me. I've never played those games, so I ask him how they work, and he tries to explain. You start at one point, and you're trying to capture or destroy the enemy's thing, and you have minions and stuff that fight each other and take down towers along the way, he says. He and his group of four friends talk about things other than the game, but when I ask if he gets together with his friends in person, he says, sometimes, but not really that often. He doesn't do much on social media sites either. When I ask him about other social activities, he says he doesn't go out much. That's when I begin to realize that playing video games is Max's only social activity. Mark is a 20-year-old community college student in Texas who describes himself as a big gamer. He met his best friend when he heard him say Snapshot, a reference to his favorite video game, Halo, in the high school hallway. They exchanged their Xbox gamer tags and have been playing together ever since. When I ask Mark what he most wants older people to understand about his generation, he surprises me by saying that the most important thing is for older people to understand how video games work. With Xbox, whenever you play online with people, you can't pause your game. Well, when your parents want something of you, they demand it then and now. And when you try to explain to them, I'm playing online with other people, I can't just pause and hop to it, they don't understand. Some young men spend so much time playing video games, they eventually have to cut themselves off. 20-year-old Darnell is majoring in business at a state university in Georgia. In high school, he says, I had a problem where I would play and I really wouldn't do anything else. I'd get out of sports practice at 8:30, 9, I'd come home and start playing video games, and I'd probably play until 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. And I'd have to be ready for school at, like, 6:30, he says. Now, he restricts his gaming to school breaks and doesn't play when classes are in session. I didn't want that to be a problem in college. There's no one to say, go to class, so I just wouldn't go to class. Overall, both boys and girls are spending much more time online and with electronic devices. Here's the thing. This time must come from somewhere. There must be something else that iGen teens are not doing that previous generations did. There are probably several, but one obvious candidate is all the other ways people used to communicate and entertain themselves. And I don't mean flip phones. Are books dead? The cool air inside the house is a welcome relief as we come in from a muggy late spring day in suburban Virginia. 13-year-old Sam opens the door to his room gingerly. His arm is encased in a black sling after he injured it tussling with a friend. His room is a mix of sports posters and school clutter with wood furniture and navy blue curtains. He plans to play football in high school and maybe wrestle as well. "I like physical sports where you take people to the ground," he tells me matter-of-factly. His favorite thing to do is hang out with his friends, and they tease each other in the easy, friendly way that only males can get away with. One friend's slight mustache inspired the nickname Pubestash, and another is dubbed the Diabito Torpedo. Although Sam prefers to see his friends in person, he also likes Snapchatting with them, especially the face swap feature, which switches the faces, but not the body or hair, of two people in a photo. "It usually ends up being super funny," he says. If he has a half hour of downtime, he'll watch SportsCenter on ESPN or sports videos on YouTube. That made me wonder, does he read Sports Illustrated or the sports section of a newspaper or books about sports? "No," he says, "I only read what's assigned for an English project. I'm not a big fan of reading for fun." Is Sam's aversion to print typical of iGen? They spend so much time on their phones, it would be an easy guess to say yes. Even if it is typical, maybe teens have never liked to read. As always, the best way to tell is to compare teens of the same age across time. Are iGen teens less likely to read than teens in previous eras? That appears to be the case. In the late 1970s, the clear majority of teens read a book or a magazine nearly every day, but by 2015, only 16% did. In other words, three times as many boomers as iGeners read a book or magazine every day. Because the survey question was written in the 1970s, before e-readers existed, it does not specify the format of the book or magazine, so millennials or iGeners who read on a Kindle or iPad would still be included. E-book readers did seem to briefly rescue books. The number who said they read two or more books for pleasure in the last year bounced back in the late 2000s. But then it sank again as iGen and smartphones entered the scene in the 2010s. By 2015, one out of three high school seniors admitted they had not read any books for pleasure in the past year, three times as many as in 1976. Even college students entering four-year universities, the young people presumably most likely to read books, are reading less. This huge decline flatly contradicts a 2014 Pew Research Center study cheered by many in publishing, which found that 16 to 29-year-olds were more likely to read books than older people. Why the difference? The Pew study included books read for school assignments, which younger people are of course more likely to have. Thus, it committed the classic mistake of a one-time study, confusing age and generation. In the data here, where everyone is the same age, iGen teens are much less likely to read books than their millennial, Gen X, and boomer predecessors. Why? Maybe because books just aren't fast enough. For a generation raised to click on the next link or scroll to the next page within seconds, books just don't hold their attention. 12-year-old Harper, whom we met earlier, makes all A's in school, but says, "I'm not a really big reading person. It's hard for me to read the same book for such a long time. I just can't sit still and be super quiet. We have to read for 20 minutes a day, and if a book takes a while to get interesting, it's really hard for me to read." Books are not the only print media in decline for iGen. The 8th and 10th grade surveys asked about reading magazines and newspapers, and the declines are steady, large, and breathtaking. Newspaper readership plummeted from nearly 70% in the early 1990s to only 10% in 2015. And this is reading a newspaper once a week or more, a fairly low bar. Magazine readership fared little better. Some of you might be thinking, yeah, no kidding. However, this is a surprising result according to many prominent theories of media use. Some researchers have argued that new technology doesn't replace older forms of media, but instead supplements them. People who are interested in a topic often seek it out in many forms of media, they point out. In addition, technology makes reading books and magazines easier, since they can be delivered instantly to iPads and Kindles. But those factors were not enough to stem the tide of the decline of print. As one librarian in a cartoon puts it as she hands a book to a teen, "Just think of it as a long text message." Are teens reading for pleasure less because they have more homework and more extracurricular activities? No. As we saw in Chapter 1, teens are spending about the same or less time on these activities than in previous decades. And recall that they also spend much less time working for pay. Eighth graders are the most clear-cut example. They spend 2 hours less on homework a week than they did in the early 1990s, but they are also much less likely to read magazines and newspapers. When NPR asked Washington, D.C. ninth grader Jamari Seidner if she ever reads, she said, "I don't really read for pleasure. I watch Netflix shows or Hulu shows, mostly TV. That's it," she said. Her friend Chiamaka Anosike said, "I don't read for pleasure either unless it's for a school assignment. I'm usually on my phone or watching TV too." Of the 200 San Diego State freshmen and sophomores I surveyed in 2015, most said they never read newspapers, and their magazine reading was restricted to celebrity gossip or fashion magazines. One was very specific. "I read magazines like Cosmopolitan when I'm flying on an airplane." A typical response mentioned required assignments for classes. "I read only if a school assignment requires it because I'd rather not spend my free time reading extensively." Although many said they enjoyed reading books, those who did not were steadfast in their dislike. "I do not enjoy books," wrote one. "They put me to sleep and they are boring." Another noted, "I do not have the patience to read books that I do not have to read." One stated flatly, "I never read any books." To paraphrase the cult classic movie The Princess Bride, print is not dead, it's just mostly dead. Or perhaps on life support. With smartphones taking up so much of teens' time, there is little left for other leisure pursuits. As one teen put it in a Chronicle of Higher Education interview, "My dad is still into the whole book thing. He has not realized that the internet kind of took the place of that." Perhaps this move away from print is innocuous, especially if teens are still keeping up their academic skills. But they are not. SAT scores have slid since the mid-2000s, especially in writing, a 13-point decline since 2006, and critical reading, a 13-point decline since 2005. Unfortunately, iGeners' academic skills lag behind their millennial predecessors by significant margins. Declines in SAT scores are often attributed to more students choosing to go to college. If more high school students take the test, the population taking the test will be a less academically talented group over time. That's probably why SAT scores declined so much between the 1970s and the 1990s, when college enrollment soared. However, that's not the case for the shift from millennials to iGen in the late 2000s and early 2010s, when college enrollment stayed fairly steady. It's interesting that the change in critical reading scores follows the same pattern as that of those reading two or more books for pleasure each year, which bumped up in the mid-2000s and then fell again. Apparently, texting and posting to social media instead of reading books, magazines, and newspapers are not a boon for reading comprehension or academic writing. That might partially be due to the short attention span that new media seem to encourage. One study installed a program on college students' laptops that took a screenshot every 5 seconds. The researchers found that students switched between tasks every 19 seconds on average. More than 75% of the students' computer windows were open less than 1 minute. This is a very different experience from sitting and reading a book for hours. The decline in reading creates some distinct challenges for a wide swath of concerned elders, including parents, educators, and publishing companies. For example, how are students who rarely read books going to digest an 800-page college textbook? Most faculty report that their students simply don't read the textbook, even if it's required. Many publishers are moving toward more interactive e-books to try to keep students engaged. As a university faculty member and the author or co-author of 3 college textbooks, I think this needs to go even further. iGeners need textbooks that include interactive activities such as video sharing and questionnaires, but they also need books that are shorter in length and more conversational in their writing style. They are coming to college with much less experience reading, so we have to meet them where they are, while still teaching them what they need to know. That might mean leaving behind some detail, but that's better than students not cracking the book at all. Regular books and magazines have already taken some of these steps, such as making their articles shorter and lowering their reading level. They may also eventually incorporate some of the same features as textbooks, embedding quizzes and polls to keep readers interested, or including images and videos just as web pages do. Perhaps then iGen, and the rest of us, will return to reading. Funny Cats Big Compilation 2017.
They have, like, a dog climbing a baby gate, and it, like, unhinges the baby gate, and you see the gate swing back with the dog on it, and you see the dog fall out of the frame. I just think it's really funny, says Chloe, the 18-year-old high school senior from Ohio we met in Chapter 1. She and her friends watch video clips on Twitter, BuzzFeed, Facebook, and YouTube, with animal videos their usual faves. There's another one she likes on YouTube. She says, the dog, like, got into something. Have you ever seen when a dog is in trouble and they know they did something and they'll kind of, like, try to smile? The dog was, like, smiling, and the video had this weird, sympathetic music. I was in love with that video for 2 days in January. I couldn't, like, not watch it every 5 minutes. These types of short video clips are very popular and have been since YouTube debuted in 2006. Although none of the overtime surveys specifically tracks the amount of time teens spend watching them, a good chunk of teens' online time is likely spent watching videos, either through social media or via sites such as YouTube. iGeners find videos through Twitter as well. 20-year-old Darnell says he follows several people on Twitter who post nothing but dog photos. So he says, sometimes I look at puppies all day. The most popular videos seem to feature fails, animals, or animal fails. Laughing babies, children drugged at the dentist, music videos, and dancing chickens have also been popular. We have the most complete and instant access to information in all of history, and we're using it to watch funny cat videos. Online videos have replaced some TV time for teens, although the declines in TV watching are not as steep as those in reading. Teens watched about an hour a day less TV in 2015 than in the early 1990s. Even with new TV options such as Netflix and Amazon Prime, funny cats are winning. And when iGeners do watch TV, it's more likely to be on demand or streaming. I don't even know how to turn on our TV at home and consume all of my television content on my laptop, wrote 17-year-old Grace Masbach in the Huffington Post. iGen teens also don't go out to see movies as often. Going to the movies stayed fairly steady through the video rental era of the 1980s and 1990s and remained robust until the mid-2000s when it started to slide. So, at least among teens, Blockbuster Video, which opened in 1985, didn't kill going to the movies, nor did Netflix's mail service, which debuted in 1997. But streaming video and other online activities did. And, of course, they also killed Blockbuster. When I asked my students if they preferred to see a movie in the theater or at home, most answered at home, citing convenience, cost, and being able to stay in their pajamas. Many iGeners prefer to personalize their movie experience in ways that can't be done at the theater. I do not quite understand people who say that they enjoy paying to go watch a movie at the movie theater, wrote Carmen, 22. With today's technology, you can stream the movie online, wear your most bum-like outfit, or don't wear pants at all, and eat snacks straight from your fridge and pantry. You can also pause, rewind, and fast-forward the movie as you please, something that does not happen in a movie theater. Ever. So, iGen is spending much more time online and texting, and much less time with more traditional media such as magazines, books, and TV. iGeners are spending so much time on their smartphones that they just aren't interested in or available to read magazines, go to movies, or watch TV, unless it's on their phones. Although TV presaged the screen revolution, the internet has hastened the demise of print. The printing press was invented in 1440, so for more than 500 years, words printed on paper were the standard way to convey information. We are living, right now, in the time when that is changing. iGen's future, and all of ours, will be shaped by this revolution. It could turn out well, with web pages supplemented by long passages of text in the form of e-books, with all of the information we'll ever need contained in our laptops and on the internet. No more recycling the newspaper, no more packing boxes of books when you move. Or it could turn out badly, with iGen and the next generations never learning the patience necessary to delve deeply into a topic, and the U.S. economy falling behind as a result. There's another, more immediate question. If teens are spending more time communicating with their friends online, how much are they seeing their friends in person? Has electronic interaction replaced face-to-face interaction? Let's find out. Chapter 3. In person, no more. I'm with you, but only virtually. Kevin and I sit down at two desks just outside his third period class at a high school in northern San Diego. He is 17 years old and Asian American, with spiky black hair, fashionable glasses, and a wan smile. He is the oldest of three children, with his parents expecting another child in a few months. Until recently, the family lived in an apartment, where the noise from his younger siblings was deafening. Perhaps as a result, he is unusually empathetic for a teenage boy.